today I'm going to, and for the rest of the class, I'm going to continue talking about the physics of this theory, single field, slow roll inflation. Before I get started, are there any questions? Okay. So the next thing I'm going to do is explain what the slow roll means in slow roll inflation. So this has a flatness condition on the potential V of phi. So let me say for any V of phi, I'll define slow roll parameters. Epsilon and eta, which are like derivatives of log V in Planck units. Let me comment that this differs from, there doesn't seem to be a standard definition of slow roll parameters. Every reference defines them a bit differently. And in particular, my definition differs slightly from the Bauman notes. I'll come back at the end and comment on that more systematically. And then the potential is slow roll. If these parameters are much less than one. A potential can be slow roll for some values of phi and not slow roll for others. The significance of this flatness condition is that I claim, and we'll show shortly, that if it's satisfied, then the equations of motion simplify, or maybe approximated. I should have said as context that I'm still specializing single field slow roll inflation to an unperturbed situation where you have exact translation and rotation invariants. That means the metric is FRW and phi is a function of time but not space. I'll put in spatial perturbations shortly. So these approximations each drop one term relative to the exact equations of motion. Let me remind you that the exact equation of motion under these FRW symmetries, the exact equation for motion for phi is this. And for the second equation, the exact equation of motion is this. Rho over 3 m Planck squared, where rho has kinetic and potential terms. So an intuitive way of thinking about the approximation that's being made here is like a particle moving in a 1D potential in a very friction-dominated situation. So if the potential is flat, so that the force pulling the potential down the particle down the potential is small compared to the Hubble friction that's trying to pin it in place. Then the physics is sort of like, if you imagine a 1D particle moving in a potential with some friction, then if the friction is large, then the equation of motion this will be a good approximation to the equation of motion. This approximation just says that the acceleration is small And the particle just ends up at whatever, at terminal velocity, at whatever velocity the friction force precisely balances the force from the potential. That's one way of thinking about this first equation where I dropped the phi double dot term. And then in the second equation, I'm dropping this phi dot term because that term goes to zero as the friction gets larger and larger. I would like it, I think it's worth the blackboard space to show that this is true. So I'm going to prove this. That'll also give some sort of useful tricks for working in the slow roll approximation. So for a formal argument that this is true, I offer the following argument. So I'm going to let if I put the subscript SR on a quantity, then that refers to the slow roll solution, which is, i.e., the exact solution to these approximate equations of motion. So I'll define this to be the exact solution to the equation, to the approximate equation of motion star. So that the real solution can be viewed as a perturbation. And then more generally, if I put the SR subscript on something, that means evaluated on the slow roll solution. And so then to prove this claim, it suffices to show that phi double dot on the slow roll solution is much smaller than V prime. I'll call that equation SR1. And that the kinetic term is much less than VSR. If these equations are satisfied, you're in sort of a perturbation theory regime where the term that I'm dropping in each equation, like phi double dot, is thought of as a term on the right-hand side of this equation. Phi double dot over 3H is small compared to V prime over 3H. So it's sort of a small perturbation to the right-hand side. And similarly over here, phi dot squared, the term that's missing on the right-hand side is small compared to the term that I'm keeping. So the true solution is, if you wanted to, you could organize as sort of a perturbation theory where you start with the slow roll solution and get the exact solution by expanding to powers of the slow roll parameters. So I'm going to show that these equations are true on the slow roll solution. The reason, something that's really technically convenient about slow roll is that you can do slow roll-ology, which means that any quantity evaluated on the slow roll solution can be converted to local derivatives of the potential. This is easiest to illustrate by example. So if I consider, for example, phi dot in the slow roll approximation. So because of the SR subscript, I'm allowed to use the slow roll equations of motion freely. So by the first equation of motion, the phi equation of motion, I'll write this. And then by the second equation of motion, I'll write this. Where I've written equals instead of approximately because I'm just using the slow roll solution and the approximate equations of motion self-consistently throughout. This was kind of a trivial example. For a less trivial example, let me do phi double dot. So then, if I just kind of follow my nose, first I'll write, phi double dot is the derivative of phi dot, and then I'm going to plug in this form for phi dot. Then, since what appears in brackets is a is now a local function of phi, I can use the chain rule and write this as the take the phi derivative, and then multiply by phi dot. In the next step, I'll differentiate this with respect to phi, obtaining this. So you can see how it's just getting organized as a bunch of local derivatives of phi. Okay, so now everything is, oh yeah, and then the phi dot, I'll use the this identity again to write it like this. So now I've succeeded in organizing everything in terms of local derivatives of the potential, and then I'll collect the answer in a nice form here on the last line. Okay. Maybe I'll raise this board a bit. So as you can see, this is a pretty mechanical procedure, and there'll be other places where I need to express some quantity in the slow roll approximation in terms of local derivatives. And I'll just write down the answer and say that it's slow roll ology if you do the calculation. I was going to give on Tuesday's tutorial a few more examples of this, but I didn't quite get to this material in time during the lecture. One more thing that I'll write down is HSR, which is actually just rewriting the second slow roll equation of motion. I guess this should have a absolute value. Wait, this should be V. Why is it V prime in minutes? As a conceptual comment, let me say that this works because the slow roll equations are first order. If the exact equations of motion being second order differential equations would mean that quantities like phi dot or phi double dot at a given point on the potential would depend on the initial conditions, like the whole history leading up to that point. And so it would not be possible to express them purely in terms of local derivatives of the potential. So now we can give the proof of, I'll do it over here. So now we can prove these identities, SR1 and SR2, that I wanted to prove. For SR1, if I calculate the ratio, phi double dot over V prime, in the slow roll approximation, then from using the identities, the slow roll ology identities, I'll just relate those to local derivatives of the potential. Now that it's been related to derivatives of the potential, I can recognize that what I have is the dimensionless ratio can be written in terms of the slow roll parameters epsilon and eta. So this is much less than one by assumption. And similarly, I wanted to show that for identity SR2, that the kinetic energy of the inflaton was always small compared to its potential energy. And so by the identities on the blackboard above, it can be worked out as follows. is epsilon over 3. So this establishes the consistency of the slow roll approximation in the sense that if both slow roll parameters are small, then if you view the terms that are being dropped here as perturbations on the right-hand side of the slow roll equations of motion, then those terms are smaller than the terms that are being retained by powers of epsilon and eta. And if you wanted to, you could do perturbation theory and write the exact solution as some power series involving the slow roll solution and powers of the slow roll parameters. One more little slow roll ology comment. Is that if you compute W in the slow roll approximation, so that's defined W by definition is the pressure over the energy density, and then plugging in the expressions for in the tutorial you worked out these expressions for P and rho in terms of phi dot and V. And then if I use the slow roll expression for phi dot now to figure out what this is in slow roll, then you get you end up with this. I'll say plus terms of order epsilon squared, just to be precise. The equation of state of single field slow roll inflation is always a little larger than minus one. Because epsilon is defined to be a square, it's always positive. A spacetime with this property where the equation of state is minus one plus a small number is sometimes said to be quasi de Sitter. Where I'm using using the following definition of a W equals minus one plus a small positive number, where I'm not sure if I defined the de Sitter metric in a previous lecture, but I'm using it to mean a flat FLRW spacetime with W equal to minus one, meaning that you have a cosmological constant, that nothing else. That implies that H is a constant. You showed that in a constant W cosmology, H is proportional to A to the minus 3 times 1 plus W over 2, which would be A to the 0 if W is minus 1. And that by integrating Friedman's equations of motion, the scale factor goes as an exponential e to the HT. You may have seen in a different area of physics a different definition of the de Sitter spacetime where lambda is, my definition, lambda is positive and curvature is 0. You may have seen a different definition where lambda is positive and curvature is also positive. If anyone is curious about that, I can explain how those definitions are related in a question or like at the, or maybe after the class. So it's useful to know that in an inflationary spacetime, H is, because of the small positive correction, H is slowly decreasing, and A is growing slightly sub-exponentially. The last thing I want to write down is, I'm going to use my definition of the slow roll parameters just so that they're roughly first and second derivatives of V. The Bauman notes use a different set of definitions. So what I call epsilon and eta, he writes as epsilon v and eta of sub v. I apologize for this, but you'll have to translate between the two definitions. So he also defines, he defines five slow roll parameters. So epsilon for him is h dot over h. I have a lot of typos in my notes. This should be h squared, I think. His eta is epsilon dot over h epsilon. And then his delta is minus phi double dot over h phi dot. If you happen to be using the Bauman textbook instead of the Bauman PDF notes, then he renamed eta to kappa in the textbook. So anyway, he defines five slow roll parameters, but in the slow roll approximation, only two of them are independent. So you can show by a slow rollology exercise that's like totally similar to the calculations that I did here, that using his notation throughout, epsilon is epsilon the same thing as epsilon sub v. Eta is the same thing as 4 epsilon v minus 2 eta sub v. So strictly speaking, this is only true to lowest order and slow roll. I find it kind of confusing to have five different slow roll parameters, but only two independent ones. And I'm also kind of used to this definition where the slow roll parameters are just defined in terms of derivatives of the potential. That's why I'm using the different notation, but it's easy to convert back and forth if you have these formulas at your fingertips. In tutorial 5, I was going to ask you to show these three identities. So that's it for the topic of slow roll. It's just some flatness conditions on the potential that let you simplify the equations of motion and simplify calculations a bit. It'll turn out that I guess that the assumption of a slow roll potential is not like super well motivated at this point. But we'll see later that it's needed to match the statistical properties of the initial conditions that I was talking about last time. So then the next thing I want to talk about is the physics of the perturbations. So what I want to do so far, I've just been talking about a zeroth order background with a lot of symmetry that I'm going to expand in powers of perturbations that are not assumed to have any particular symmetry. What I want to do is rather than specializing this theory to the case of FRW symmetry, I want to specialize it to a situation where phi has the highly symmetric form plus a small first order perturbation. And then all components of the metric have a zeroth order FRW piece plus a first order perturbation that depends on x and t. It has no special symmetry. At a mechanical level, what I'm doing is just substituting this phi and this metric into these equations of motion. I want to end up with, my goal is going to be to get the equations of motion to first order in the perturbations. This is the goal. And And then the action to second order, it turns out I also need. So in principle, that's just like a really mechanical calculation that I could just write down the answer. But I thought it might be more interesting to sort of tell a little story about how dynamical degrees of freedom work in GR. So I'll tell the story in sort of a general way, and then I'll walk through it in the specific example. So here's sort of a physical puzzle for you guys. In GR, the equations of motion can be written in Einstein's equation, can be written in the super ultra compact form with 10 degrees of freedom in both sides. This is a really powerful way of writing the equations of motion that makes like the symmetry properties manifest, the invariance under coordinate transformations. It doesn't really give much insight into how to evolve the equations, say, on the computer. And it also obscures how many dynamical degrees of freedom there really are. This way of writing Einstein's equations as 10 equations and 10 unknowns might suggest that a gravity wave has 10 polarizations. A real gravity wave detector like LIGO measures 2 polarizations of the gravity waves. So a question you might ask is, how do you get from 10 to 2? I want to write and explain that in GR, the counting of degrees of freedom works something like this. You start with 10 degrees of freedom in the metric. And then I'm going to say that you subtract 4 by choosing a gauge or a system of coordinates. You'll also subtract 4 degrees of freedom that turn out to be non-dynamical to end up with 2. It's actually kind of hard to prove that that always happens. I think it's useful pedagogically to explain how something similar happens in electromagnetism, where you can really write everything down in a few lines. In electromagnetism, with my sign convention for the metric and in units where 4 pi epsilon naught is 1, Maxwell's equations can be written in this ultra-compact form. There's a similar puzzle where the gauge field A mu appears to have 4 degrees of freedom, but light physically has 2 polarizations. The way the counting works is that you remove 1 degree of freedom and you choose a gauge, and then another degree of freedom by eliminating a non-dynamical variable to end up with 2 degrees of freedom, just like GR. As you know from electromagnetism, let me just write this down in a few lines. Equations are invariant under this so-called gauge transformation, this symmetry of the theory is sort of understood to be a redundancy of description. The same way that in GR, if you make a coordinate transformation, you're not really operating on the fields. The interpretation isn't a new field configuration. It's just a different representation of the old field configuration, or a representation in different coordinates. Electromagnetism is similar, where these two gauge fields related by this gauge transformation are understood to be different representations of the same underlying electromagnetic field. You can choose a gauge or use this gauge freedom to absorb some of the degrees of freedom. I'll choose the so-called Coulomb gauge. Uh, where the divergence of the spatial three vector is zero. Okay. And then if you write down the equations of motion in the Coulomb gauge, so I mean, I'll gauge fix first and then write down the equations of motion. Then in a 3+1 dimensional notation, you can write them this way. I guess my notation here is a little weird because I'm mixing 4D and 3+1D, but you get the idea. The key point here is that the equation of motion for A0, or the potential phi, doesn't contain any time derivatives. And so A0 doesn't have independent dynamics. If you know the source current, J mu, on a given time slice, then you can, that's all the data that you need to solve this equation for A0. It's not something that you, has an equation of motion involving time that you need to integrate. It's just this auxiliary quantity that sort of goes along for the ride and is determined by the dynamical quantities. You could eliminate it completely from the equations of motion, if you like, by just substituting it in to the second equation. Sorry, I should have put a dot here. If I did that, then I could just forget that A0 existed and treat Maxwell's equations as differential equations just involving A. So the way the degrees of freedom counting work is that I lost one degree of freedom when I eliminated one degree of freedom when I chose the gauge. And then in a given gauge, when you write down the equations of motion, you should always find that there's a one degree of freedom in there somewhere that's non-dynamical. And I did that for the Coulomb gauge, but you could do the same thing with a different gauge. The details will depend on the gauge choice. Another little technical comment is that, generally speaking, you only get sensible equations of motion after you choose a gauge. More precisely, if you try to write down the equations of motion without choosing a gauge, then you'll get an undetermined system with a gauge mode whose evolution is just not constrained by the equations. One way of seeing that formally is that if you have, I'll draw a cartoon. If you have some initial data, you'd like your equations of motion to have the property that the future behavior, the evolution of the fields, is determined by the initial data, at least if I specify enough time derivatives. If you don't gauge fix, then the equations of motion don't have this property that the future evolution is determined by the initial data. Because if I had one solution, then I could just change it by gauge mode. I know that anything of this type is also a solution. Where I choose alpha to be zero on and near the initial hypersurface and then non-zero at later times, then I can end up with a second solution that looks different at later times. So there's a formal sense in which the underdeterminedness of the equations of motion is like a formal consequence of gauge invariance, and it happens in GR too. In GR, you know, it's the same sort of thing where you can just choose two systems of coordinates that agree at early times and disagree at late times. Then the field configuration G mu nu will be different functions of the coordinates, and they'll both satisfy the equations of motion. Okay. So in GR, we also if we're specializing Einstein's equations to some specific situation, like inflation, then we should choose the gauge first. We expect to choose the gauge first. Then we'll get equations of motion that are sensible, fully determined. And then we should always find, when we pick apart those equations of motion, that of the 6 degrees of freedom that remain after choosing the gauge, that 4 of them are non-dynamical. Their equations of motion do not contain time derivatives. And there are only 2 true dynamical degrees of freedom. One final comment is that in inflation, there will be 3 dynamical degrees of freedom, 2 from the metric, plus 1 for the inflaton phi in inflation. So 3 in inflation. Okay. So let's try to follow this roadmap. To ask if there are any questions on this pair before going. Okay. So let me bring down this board. So the first step is going to be choosing a gauge, but I wanted to find a little bit of notation first. So I'll define a little change of variables. This is just a change of variables, not a gauge choice. I'm going to change in this perturbed metric. I'll represent the spatial part of the metric, the 3x3 object delta Gij, by a scalar field zeta and a traceless symmetric tensor gamma ij, defined like this. Be a function of x and t, and gamma ij should be a function of x and t, where gamma is traceless. So this is just this definition is just splitting up the 3x3 matrix delta Gij into a trace term, a term proportional to delta ij, denoted zeta. And then a traceless term denoted gamma ij. So with those definitions, there's more than one interesting gauge in inflation, but just like electrodynamics. I decided to use the unitary gauge, which is one where delta phi is 0. And then there's this gauge condition on the object gamma ij, which is kind of similar to the Coulomb gauge in electrodynamics. One thing that's a little weird about the unitary gauge is that it's possible to gauge away through a appropriate set of coordinates the perturbation in the phi field. That might seem a little counterintuitive, since the fluctuations in phi are supposed to play an important role in the physics of inflation. But you can always choose coordinates to make phi look unperturbed. The cartoon of that is just that, in an unperturbed situation, the if this is a space-time diagram with T and X axes, if I think about the surfaces of constant phi, they're just horizontal. Now if I put in a perturbation, they get perturbed and there's no special symmetry. But then I can always choose a new time coordinate t prime so that the surfaces of constant t prime coincide with these curves, with the surfaces of constant phi. In that new coordinate t prime, just by construction, phi depends on t prime but not x, and so it's unperturbed. More formally, I want to claim that starting from an arbitrary set of perturbations, let me write that as an arbitrary delta phi, an arbitrary zeta, and an arbitrary gamma ij. There exists a unique gauge transformation. Yeah, so far, let me write it this way. So here goes the x mu plus epsilon mu of x. So far I've been talking about gauge transformations or coordinate transformations in GR without really introducing notation for them. In GR, coordinate transformations are sometimes called gauge transformations. One way in which GR is a lot more complicated than electrodynamics is that the equations of motion are nonlinear, and so are the gauge transformations. If I apply a change of coordinates to some set of fields, then the result is nonlinear in the gauge transformation. If the gauge transformation is small, so here I'm working in a perturbation theory situation where the unperturbed background is zeroth order, and I'm perturbing it by some small first order transformations. And so in that perturbation theory, this epsilon mu should be some first order quantity. So to first order, a coordinate transformation is just a vector field, because you can draw the coordinate transformation as just, you know, perturbing the coordinates of each point in space-time by some small amount that can be represented as a vector in each point. So I can think of if I'm just working to first order and not introducing the nonlinear terms, then I can think of a gauge transformation as just being parameterized by a vector field. What you'd want to work out then is if you make this transformation with some vector field epsilon mu, how these perturbations change. So that can be done by sort of a brute force calculation in just conceptually. If these objects transform as scalars and tensors, then I can use the transformation law for scalars and tensors under a small change in coordinate system. I could start with the general rule for a coordinate transformation, specialized to the case where the coordinate transformation is small, and then just expand to lowest order in the perturbation. Now you guys, in your GR class, did you study something called the Lie derivative by any chance? A better way of doing it is the Lie derivative, which just kind of packages up that operation of making a first order coordinate transformation into some into a derivative operator, the Lie derivative.
So I think there's a minus sign here, if I remember correctly. So that the change in the in phi, when you apply the gauge transformation, is just given by taking the Lie derivative of phi, and since epsilon here is first order, and I want the result first order, it suffices to compute the Lie derivative on the zeroth order background. And then the same thing is true for the components of the metric. I just take Lie derivatives of those. So this turns out to be not doing this. The metric would transform like this. I'm not doing this calculation in total detail because I think it's a bit of a tangent. I just kind of want to explain why it's possible to, why the unitary gauge is well defined, why it's possible to make this gauge choice. Anyway, either by using the Lie derivative or by going back to the rule for applying coordinate transformations to scalars and tensors, there's a little check you can do where you can show that if I work in Fourier space, the effect of a gauge mode is to perturb delta phi by something proportional to epsilon zero. And then if I I'm interested in this quantity, this is the other quantity I'm trying to set to zero in the unitary gauge, then it transforms like this. Maybe I should have. Change the indices around a little. I'm probably getting a little carried away by explaining how the unitary gauge is well defined. But if you stare at these equations, you can see that if I start with something non-zero here on the right-hand side, and I want to apply a gauge transformation to am I missing a K squared? Think I'm missing a K squared here. Yeah. If I start with something non-zero on the right-hand side, and then I want to apply a gauge transformation to end up with zero, then working one Fourier mode at a time, there's a unique choice of epsilon mu of k that accomplishes that. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, yes.
Just to clarify, because in gauges where Lorentz invariance is broken, it's easy to make mistakes. Is this k squared the 4 vector or the 3 vector?
Oh, yeah, sorry. This k here always means the 3 vector. Yeah, I'm mixing like four-dimensional notation and 3 plus 1-dimensional notation. Yeah, my notation will always be that at least after gauge fixing, where I'm sort of writing down differential equations in a form where you could put them on the computer, that x always means a 3 vector. And then k is its, let's say x always means a co-moving spatial coordinate or three vector, and k is its Fourier conjugate or a co-moving wave number. Yeah, thanks. That was a really good question. Maybe it's clearer if I put vectors over the case. Does anyone else have a question? Okay. Also comment that another popular gauge choice, so I chose to use the epsilon zero gauge freedom to set the inflaton perturbation to zero. That's what's called the unitary gauge. Another popular choice is to set zeta to zero, and that's called the spatially flat gauge. It's what's used in the Bauman notes. And you can sort of go back and forth between the moving, the scalar perturbation, between the metric zeta and the inflaton field phi. Okay, so now I wanted to write down the equations of motion to in the unitary gauge to first order and the action to second order, and I'm just going to write this down quickly because it's just a mechanical calculation, and I don't really know a good way of like speeding it up. But it's a really long calculation. The equations of motion, you know, have there's a bunch of cases depending on whether indices are spatial or time-like, and each case is kind of a a few pages of algebra. So first, just some definitions. I've parameterized the, remember in the unitary gauge, there's no phi, it's unperturbed. As mentioned before, I've parameterized the space-space part of the metric by a scalar quantity zeta and a traceless symmetric tensor gamma ij. And then I've introduced this notation A and B for the time-time and time-space parts of the metric. With those definitions, the equations of motion, after a bunch of calculation and simplification, can be written this way. I won't really be... really use these full equations of motion. I'll just use them briefly to read off which variables are dynamical or non-dynamical. So in these equations of motion, as expected, there are four non-dynamical quantities, meaning that the equations of motion don't have time derivatives. They can have spatial derivatives. The quantities A and BI. And so I can just, for purposes of thinking about the system of equations, I can just sort of disregard these equations of motion. All they say is that these components of the metric, the time-time and time-space part of the metric, are just determined algebraically by the space-space part of the metric in a way that's just local to each surface of constant time. It has no dynamics in it. The dynamical degrees of freedom are here in the space-space part of the metric, and they have these more interesting equations of motion with time derivatives. And so for the rest of the course, I'll just consider these to be these equations to be the equations of motion. And just forget about the non-dynamical equations of motion for A and B. At this point, the number of degrees of freedom has been reduced from 11 for phi plus the metric to 7 by making the gauge choice, and then finally to 3 by eliminating the 4 non-dynamical degrees of freedom. So the dynamical degrees of freedom here are just zeta. I chose to put the scalar degree of freedom into zeta instead of phi by choosing unitary gauge, plus 2 for the object gamma ij. It's 3 degrees of freedom. Physically, these 2 degrees of freedom will be gravity wave degrees of freedom with 2 polarizations. Okay. So these 2 equations are going to be really useful in what follows. The other thing that I'd like to write down is just the action to second order, which is another giant calculation. If I specialize the action for single field Sorolle inflation to these perturbations in the unitary gauge, and then using the non-dynamical equations of motion for A and B to eliminate those variables where they appear in the action, then another really long calculation gives this form of the action, which is called the Mukhanov-Sasaki action. It's got a scalar piece. Let me raise the board.
Can I ask a question first?
Yes, yes.
The question for BI, what have we written between phi dot squared and z?
So yes, this is the spatial Laplacian to the minus 2. Yeah, it's easiest to think about it in Fourier space, where it just, you know, applying this operator just means multiplying by every Fourier mode by minus 1 over k squared. It also appears, if the electrodynamics is still on the board, a similar thing happens in Coulomb gauge in E&M. Delta to the minus 2 appears in the equation of motion. You can also think of that operator as, in E&M, the Laplacian of the potential is the charge. So you could think of the operator delta to the minus 2 as being the operator that solves Poisson's equation and produces a potential given a density. One final comment on this business of like counting degrees of freedom in GR. In electromagnetism, like the whole picture is really transparent. the way that this counting works and how the non-dynamical degrees of freedom arise. But in GR, it's really hard to see that it generally happens. Like it's sort of, I sort of presented it in a way where it comes out of a calculation. Like in a specific theory, if you calculate the equations of motion, four non-dynamical degrees of freedom appear after gauge fixing. But as far as I know, like the first time this was really shown to happen generally in GR was the famous ADM paper from around 1960, introducing the ADM variables into GR. The ADM variables are just a different set of variables for doing GR, a different set of variables than the usual JMU-nu, where this separation of degrees of freedom into dynamical and non-dynamical is manifest. But the symmetries are not so manifest, I think it's really interesting that that paper followed Einstein's development of GR by about 45 years, and took about 45 years apparently for physicists to really understand in a concrete general way how this counting works in GR and how the non-dynamical degrees of freedom appear. I don't know why, but I got so excited about this counting of degrees of freedom that I went 5 minutes over. So maybe we should pause there. Feel free to like come up and ask questions, and then we'll resume next time, and I'll answer any questions about any of this stuff before moving on to the quantum mechanics. So these results, the equations of motion to first order and the action to second order, are all that we'll need to start to quantize the theory and start explaining the quantum mechanical production mechanism for producing fluctuations in these fields. Yes?
I was just wondering if there is any other gains. So is that as commonly used with this?
The only one that I really know of is the so-called spatially flat gauge. So the unitary gauge is an inflation that, as far as I know, the only gauges that are really useful are the unitary gauge, where you gauge away the inflaton perturbation, and then you also have this Coulomb gauge-like condition on the gravity waves. And then the spatially flat gauge is very similar, where you use the time reparameterization to gauge away zeta, restoring the fluctuation to the inflaton, and then same condition on the gravity waves. In other parts of cosmology, like the physics after inflation and before the formation of the CMB, where the physics of the universe is like propagating sound waves in a plasma, then there are a lot more interesting gauge choices. There are sort of like four or five different gauges that are all interesting for one reason or another. But inflation, as far as I know, only these two are really, really useful.
Do we still have Lorentz invariance in the action? In the end of the day, like we have restored everything, we arrive at this action over here. Is it still Lorentz invariant or not?
I would not quite say it's Lorentz invariant. That's an interesting question. Generally speaking, the gauge breaks the Lorentz invariance. We're using sort of like a preferred slicing where, you know, time is a privileged coordinate. It's the coordinate where along which the inflaton changes. If W happens to equal minus one, then if you're in the exacta sitter case, then it turns out there's a really non-obvious symmetry enhancement. There's some extra symmetries which are not the Lorentz symmetries. And so, Yeah, there's a technical sense in which, so in inflation, W is always a little bit larger than minus one, and so those symmetries are approximate. But there are some sort of extra hidden approximate symmetries floating around that are have interesting consequences in inflation. But generally speaking, when you introduce a background with time evolution, it's breaking the Lorentz symmetry. Just like the general FRW spacetime doesn't have boost symmetries. So this is a really natural stopping point because we're stopping right on the GR QFT boundary. Next week, I'm just sort of going to use these equations of motion and the action that come out of the GR calculation as the starting point for quantizing a field theory based on these quantities, and I'll explain how the perturbations get quantum mechanically produced.